It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins will be in Des Moines tonight. He's one of two poets giving this year's Buxbaum Lecture at Drake University, along with Clint Smith. The event is this evening at 7 p.m. Billy Collins has done many things over the years. He's published 15 collections of poetry. His latest is The Rain in Portugal, and he's agreed to spend some time with us today. Billy Collins, welcome back to the show.
Well, great. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me again.
And let's start off with a poem from that collection, The Rain in Portugal. And the title of the collection kind of relates to this poem, since, most of us think about the rain in Spain. Portugal doesn't rhyme quite as much. So would you read for us the poem on rhyme?
Sure. You're supposed to sense the absence of Spain in the title. And the poem is called On Rhyme. It's possible that a stitch in time might save as many as 12 or as few as 3, and I have no trouble remembering that September has 30 days. So do June, November, and April. I like a cat wearing a chapeau or a trilby, little Jack Horner sitting on a sofa, old men who are not from Nantucket, and how life can seem almost unreal when you are gently rowing a boat down a stream. That's why, instead of recalling today that it falls mostly in Spain, I'm going to picture the rain in Portugal, how it falls on the hillside vineyards, on the surface of the deep harbors where fishing boats are swaying, and in the narrow alleys of the cities, where three boys in T-shirts are kicking a soccer ball in the rain, ignoring the window cries of their mothers.
That's Billy Collins reading On Rhyme from his latest collection of poetry, The Rain in Portugal. And, of course, a lot of us, when we think about poetry, those rhyming couplets are some of the first things that come to our mind. By consciously sidestepping that poetic device, what are you trying to do?
All right. Well, I'm not taking up sides, for sure. I mean, I've taught English literature for decades, and most of it rhymes, and I enjoy formal poetry, written today. It's just that, and don't tell anybody this, just between you and me, but I'm just not very good at rhyming. I just don't think in rhyme. And I think today, to be a good rhymer, you need to be a very clever rhymer. The days of Moon, June, Spoon are kind of past us.
Just recently on Talk of Iowa, we were talking about Walt Whitman because one of his lost novels, apparently, the only lost novel we know about so far, has just been published. And we were talking about how his poetry with Leaves of Grass really changed everything for poets in the United States and maybe poets around the world. And it made me wonder, who are your major influences as poets?
Well, he was, in a way. He was the first one, to show that you could write something without end rhyme and regular meter. Shakespeare writes in regular meter, that iambic pentameter usually, but doesn't rhyme, and that's called blank verse, as we English majors know. But Whitman was really the first, and certainly the first major poet, to have no end rhyme and no regular metronomic meter. And at the time, a lot of people thought, well, this is poetry, because poetry was thought to be synonymous with the super glue, if you will, of rhyme and meter that held it together. And one rather prescient observer at the time said about Leaves of Grass, he said, if this isn't poetry, it is something greater than poetry. So, Whitman was the first to kind of break that mold. But I've had so many influences, it's hard to say. But I think most poets tend to learn a little something from a lot of people rather than having one dominant influence. So one of the things I learned from Whitman was to precise images. But the other thing I learned from Whitman that's more important, I think, is intimacy. Because even though Whitman is talking about the whole country often and ranging from coast to coast, many of his poems feel very whispered. They feel very like he knows who you are. He knows you're sitting there. He knows what you're looking at. And I really want to be alone with the reader.
Thinking about that kind of reach, that kind of touch that you have as a poet, what purpose do you think reading a poem that can touch you in such an intimate way, what does that do for you that maybe reading a novel or some other art form can't do?
Oh, well, it's quick. I mean, it's the most immediate, and it's an injection of something rather than kind of being spoon-fed a long novel. And I like the alacrity and the brevity of poetry, how in, a poem that can be read in maybe 45 seconds can actually turn your head around and flip your heart in some other direction. And I think also the pleasure is not just having an emotional sensation, but going on a little imaginative ride with the poet and enjoying the play of mind that one can observe in an imaginatively playful and interesting poem.
People often observe the similarity between poetry and song lyrics. There have been many poems that have been turned into songs. There are many song lyrics that resemble poems. And, of course, Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature, a songwriter, for his song lyrics. Do you feel that connection between what you're doing and writing music?
I write with my ear. I mean, even though I've confessed to you privately that I'm not a good rhymer. I do write with my ear. I want to make the poem sound good. And there are lots of ways to do that without having formal rhyme. And Charles Wright defined poetry as language that means more and sounds better. And I think those are the really two ingredients. Poetry just sounds better than non-poetry. There was another part to your question I'm not getting at. I forget.
Well, with the connection between music and, right, yes.
Yeah. Well, when I found out about Bob Dylan getting the Nobel Prize, I mean, I stood up and threw my harmonica up in the air. I thought that was great. I think often you have to play catch-up with the Nobel Prize literature winner because it's often an obscure poet or writer from another country that maybe hasn't even been fully translated into English. But everybody knows who Bob Dylan is. But I think he's the rare exception. I just read a little quote by Ira Gershwin that I don't have in front of me, but he said, basically, song lyrics are written to go with a melody, in addition to themselves, the words. And he said that kind of proves the point that they're not poetry. They're not to be read without the music. Just about any popular song, if you take away the music, the lyrics cannot stand up on their own. And if you stood up in front of an audience with a piece of paper and with lyrics to Light My Fire, for example, on them, the audience will start throwing things at you and want their money back. So I think Bob Dylan, maybe Leonard Cohen, maybe Paul Simon, there are a few exceptions where the lyrics hold up without the music, but they weren't ever intended to, so why should they stand alone?
Last time you were on the show, back in 2014, we talked a lot about the importance of poetry in schools and in public places, something that you feel very strongly about. And of course, a lot of people feel that poetry is one of the arts that is often undervalued. A lot of people right now are feeling that arts themselves, all arts, are undervalued. Mm-hmm. What is your reaction right now to the legislative pushes to defund public arts programs like the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities?
Well, it seems completely an example of cultural hostility or political hostility. I mean, when you look at the pie graph of where federal money goes, I mean, the arts are, you can barely see it. I mean, it's not really a piece of pie. It's just a little line. It's 0.001% of this enormous budget. So I think to try to justify cutting funding to the arts by saying we could use the money elsewhere, like, the jet fuel on an F-13 for about a half an hour might blow the whole arts budget. That's probably an exaggeration. But I don't think that's a justification. So I see it as, if there are these cuts, I see them as acts of just outright contemptuousness and hostility, therefore terribly lamentable.
I have heard from some artists in recent months who've said that in spite of possible funding cuts and that kind of cultural hostility, that this may be an exciting time for art in the United States because art often thrives in a hostile environment. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's true to a certain extent. I think it's also lamentable that it has to come to that. But if you look at especially cultures that value poetry, let's just take Ireland and Russia as two examples. Those are both countries that have suffered terrible kinds of oppression and lack of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And often it's in that denial, in that atmosphere of oppression and almost impossibility, that poetry, because it's so portable, will thrive. And I think the whole, you know, if you have a negative political climate, it does, the silver lining on all of that is that it does remind one of what one really stands for and what one believes in. Because if the government kind of reflects your values, you can kind of, you can go along for the ride for 4 years or 8 years. But if the government starts to, if the temperament of the government is opposed to your value system, then it wakes you up. So there could be that kind of alarm, the positive effect of that alarm of making people just more aware of what they believe in.
Over the years, you've shared a lot of stories about your mother's love for poetry and how her ability to kind of work poetry into her everyday life was a powerful force in shaping you as you grew. Do you have some advice for parents who would like to help their children think in that way, to give them the gift of poetry?
Well, I think you don't need to do much when children are very young because they're all natural poets, just as they're natural painters and dancers. And, you know, they're perfectly willing to put on some music to start jumping all around the room. And if you put out some crayons or whatever, they'll draw you a chicken or a pig or a moon or something. You don't need to instruct children very much about being creative. But to sustain that through later childhood and then into the difficult straits of adolescence is another thing entirely. And I think basically, you know, starting by reading to children in bed or not in bed, but I think that's one of the great acts any adult can perform, period. And I think if children get to associate story and language with the comfort of being read to by a benevolent adult, usually a parent, I think that embeds, if not a love for literature, at least a respect for it and a respect for language.
With little kids, as you said, they're not afraid of poetry. They will sit down and write a poem at the briefest suggestion if they don't think about it themselves. It's a lot harder for an adult to sit down and write a poem. It's a scary and a vulnerable thing to do. What do you think, even if we write bad poetry, what do you think the act of writing a poem can do for somebody?
Well, children don't have to think about it. I mean, they don't think they're committing an act of literature the way, you know, an adult might think, I'm going to make this really good. Often when adults sit down to write poetry, they become different creatures and not better creatures, really. They become a little more, you know, they become a little better than they usually are, for one thing. They censor out a lot of their lives. I'm not talking about embarrassing things, just they censor out their grouchiness, their impatience. And they aspire to a kind of purity and an earnestness, a sincerity that they don't really carry around in life. And that's why a lot of poems don't ring true, I think. But with children, they have no, there's no self-consciousness there. You can, here's a pencil and write a poem about the moon and put your sister in there too. They're fine. They'll just get on it.
I mentioned earlier you're going to be giving the Buxbaum Lecture at Drake University, along with fellow poet Clint Smith. What can people expect at the lecture?
Well, a fist fight, probably.
That would make the news.
There'll be slam poetry in the real sense of the word. I haven't met Clint Smith. I've boned up a little bit and read some of his poems, and he's a forceful poet. He's won the slam poetry national championship, which is quite an accomplishment. And so he's going to make a big noise. I'm not much of a slammer. I'm a quieter poet, but I think it'll make for a good contrast, and it'll show. And there might be some commonalities there too, because all of poetry is, you know, it's about love and death and a few other things I can't think of right now. But it will show that poetry, the word poetry, is written on a very big tent, and under that tent, a lot of verbal activities can take place that have very little resemblance to one another. So you'll certainly get a range of expression.
As we are running out of time, would you read us one more poem before you go?
Sure. Well, here's a little poem. I was reading Elizabeth Bishop, and she has a poem called Sleeping on the Ceiling and one called Sleeping Standing Up, and I thought, let me just write something more realistic. So the poem is called Sleeping on My Side. Every night, no matter where I am, when I lie down, I turn my back on half the world. At home, it's the East I ignore with its theaters and silverware as I face the adventurous West. But when I'm on the road in some hotel's room 213 or 402, I could be pointed anywhere. Yet I hardly care as long as you are there facing the other way, so we are defended in all degrees. And my left ear is pressing down as if listening for hoofbeats in the ground.
Billy Collins, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins, he'll be in Des Moines tonight. He's one of two poets giving this year's Buxbaum Lecture at Drake University, along with Clint Smith. The event is this evening at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.